This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to this week's show. I'm here again with Luke.
Hey.
And turn that mic a little towards you.
Better?
Yeah. Okay. You don't talk loud to begin with. All right. And also, I wanted to mention real quick, I have up on the site that is not being aired on the air.
The Opinions Express.
A midweek podcast with Aaron Gullius and Devo Spice on Doctor Who. Obviously not... obviously fictional material. However, I think there's a big crossover audience between Doctor Who and the stuff we're talking about here. I originally did it for my music show back in October and then decided I would toss it in on this show after posting it to the Facebook page, and a lot of people were really interested in it. Plus, Aaron is such a regular guest on here, I figured I'd give another side to his research. So if you're interested in that, you got to go to the website, wheredidtheroadgo.com, and you can download that. As well, the John Anthony West interview is up there in video format on YouTube, audio format on the website. And I am collecting stories for another listener story episode at some point over the summer. So if you have something that's happened to you and you want to talk about it, shoot me an email. Go to wheredidtheroadgo.com, get in touch, and we'll work it out. Our guest tonight, however, is Mr. Michael M. Hughes. And are you with us, Michael?
I sure am.
All right. And you're based out of Baltimore?
Sure am. Yep. Lived here all my life.
Okay. You want to give people a little bit of your background? Because you're into a lot of interesting stuff.
Yeah, sure. I guess my interest in the paranormal, the strange, goes back to as early as I can remember. It was the 70s when I was growing up, so the paranormal stuff just was infused in the culture. You couldn't get away with it in pop culture. My father was always reading paperbacks about UFOs and ghosts and Bigfoot and all that stuff. So, I'd pick up these books that he'd leave around, and I just started absorbing all of it. In Search Of was on TV, right. And a friend of my father's hosted a private showing of Chariots of the Gods, so
nice.
I saw that when I was a kid. So, I was just born and immersed in this stuff. I had some kind of strange experiences as a kid too, which, we can get into at some point. There was a little bit of a reality to this stuff as well in my life. This is what I live and breathe. I started writing fiction. My fiction is all about this stuff because it's just a part of me. And when I'm writing stories, it all comes out in my stories. And, I guess I've been lucky. Some people might not consider it lucky throughout my life to have experienced unusual stuff that I can't explain very well, but... it's one thing just to study this material, but it's another thing when it starts happening to you too. It's really the driving force in all of my writing and all of my studies. It's really just to try to understand what is behind a lot of these types of phenomena.
Right, right. And why did you decide to write fiction instead of like research material?
Well, I do a little bit of both, but I've always loved fiction, and also, as a kid, I was lucky enough that, the works of Poe and H.G. Wells and H.P. Lovecraft, stuff like that was what you could find in the library. So that became part of me, too. And then I read Stephen King, who really took horror and brought it into the modern era, out of the haunted castles and the deserted moors and things like that. And that really inspired me to start writing myself. So I also look at fiction as a great way to explore a lot of these subjects in a way that allows you to explore it. You can sort of go down different avenues that you can't do when you're writing nonfiction.
Right, right. And your debut novel was entitled The Blackwater Lights.
Mm-hmm.
And what is Blackwater?
Well, Blackwater is a fictional town in West Virginia. I went to college in a small town of Elkins, West Virginia, and I really learned to love the state. But also there was a real spookiness about West Virginia, you know. It's still vastly, you know, wild and underpopulated. And, you know, there was just a vibe about West Virginia that really captured me. So I set it in a small fictional town called Blackwater. And Blackwater is an allusion to a lot of things, but at the time, there was the government contracted company Blackwater that was active in Iraq and things like that.
Right,
so
right.
It's a kind of play on that and you know, some other things.
I didn't know if maybe there was a connection to the Brown Mountain Lights. For some reason that drew me into that direction for, you know, just the name.
Yeah, well, that's the Blackwater Lights is about that sort of phenomenon.
And right.
this fictional town of Blackwater, there are these ghost lights or earth lights or whatever you want to call them, that are sort of what draws the main character into the story.
Okay. Now, you said you had an excerpt you could read us. It was a couple minutes long?
Sure, yeah. This is, just to set it up, the main protagonist, his name is Ray Simon, and he's a 40-something school teacher living in Baltimore when the book starts. But what happened is when he was a kid, he went to a summer camp in the town of Blackwater, West Virginia. And ever since that, he's had terrifying dreams about something that happened to him at this camp. And the way the book starts is his friend, who was also at the camp, who also has had the same dreams, strange dreams of doctors and machines and experiments, but all very vague and unsettling. And they've never been able to pin down what's happened. So when the book starts, Ray's friend calls him and says, "I'm here in Blackwater. I know what happened. It was real. And you've got to come see me." So this little excerpt jumps ahead. This is a bit of a reveal. Ray has met this sort of secret society that has a base in Blackwater. And there are two characters, Micah and Mantu, who are the two men who are part of the society. And when it starts, they're revealing to Ray a little bit of what happened. So it's about a one and a half, two-minute thing.
Okay.
So I'll start here. Micah stood and faced the stove. Let's start with what we know. It was the height of the Cold War. And if you knew the right people, you could get funding for almost anything. Uncle Sam was throwing untraceable money at all sorts of projects, and there was a lot of interest in esoteric matters in those days. The supernatural, witchcraft, extrasensory perception, and the like. The military was at the center of that interest. Ray nodded. My uncle, Uncle Bill, the guy who took me to the camp, was into all that. Uri Geller and Kreskin and bending spoons. He tried to get me to bend a spoon with my mind. I couldn't do it. My mom thought he was nuts. But he was serious. Many people were serious about those things, including the governments of the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and both of them thought the other was gaining the advantage. And factions within the governments were obsessed with the pursuit of occult knowledge. In particular, the MK Ultra and Bluebird contingents, and the remote viewers at Fort Meade, Project One, and Mirror, of course. Your uncle, Mantu said, was a sociopath. Micah held up his hand to quiet Mantu. One group, which formed in 1947, was infamous for its research into, well, very unusual subjects. They were mostly CIA, but later also NSA and high-level military intel. They traveled around the world studying occult technologies from many cultures, from Asia to Africa to the Amazon and Haiti, particularly shamanism and witchcraft. Witchcraft, something he would have never believed only a few days earlier. It was known informally as Project Mirror, and it was enormously successful, way beyond what they had expected. But their success came with a heavy price. The men who got in the deepest, the ones putting the techniques into practice, had a tendency to die early or lose their minds. The hair on the back of Ray's neck stiffened. This is about the lights, isn't it? Mantu nodded to Micah. He's getting it.
All right. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're using a lot of real events, real information that you're putting into this fictional setting.
Oh, yeah. And that's what I meant by fiction giving you the option to explore things. I think the best sort of scary fiction is stuff that is as close to reality as possible. So, and you know, because this is stuff that I've been fascinated by, government research into psychic abilities and the remote viewing programs and things like that, you know, this stuff comes out in my fiction. So I like to think that a reader who's not familiar with this stuff is reading this and might think, oh, I'm going to go Google MK Ultra, you know, and then they're going to find this government mind control program was actually very real.
Right.
So, you know, it adds a layer of reality, I think, which pulls people deeper into the stories and makes and just gives it a lot more power.
And I think it's interesting when you deal with things like MK Ultra, you see the horrible things that that the government has done to its own citizens over the years. And yet there are people who, even if they know about this stuff, still think, well, that was then, they wouldn't do anything like that now.
Right. I mean, you know, I did a couple of articles on my blog when the Abu Ghraib stuff was coming out about what was going on in Iraq and some of these prisons that the government was running. And man, I mean, if you go back and look at what was happening there, you know, they were doing mind control stuff. It's quite clear. I mean, the way I look at it is, you know, some of these factions within the government probably thought this is our prime time to start working on this stuff again. And mm-hmm. You look at some of the reports from people that were there, they talk about rooms with like candles and just some of these techniques, these things that they were doing to people. It's, you know, I'm sure in 10, 15 years, things are going to come out that are just absolutely mind-boggling and rival the horrible things that were done in the MK Ultra program, the 50s, 60s, 70s.
Yeah, and, you know, we never know the stuff that doesn't come out either.
Of course, yep.
Now, is this character in the books loosely based on you?
Not really. You know, okay. Luckily I was never, you know, subject to government mind control experiments, or at least I don't think I was. But you know, he's really, you know, the book really. What I tried to do was take all of these kind of esoteric and strange things that have fascinated me, and to roll them into a story that I hope will be captivating, and at the same time, people are enjoying the story and getting wrapped up in it. Is maybe it'll spark an interest into looking into some of this stuff.
Right. Okay. What kind of experiences did you have as a kid?
Well, the thing that really shakes me the most, and I still go back to, is I have very distinct memories from probably when I was 6, 7, 8 years old, around that age, of seeing lights in my bedroom. This would happen either while I was in my bedroom or when I was in the hallway of my parents' house. And the thing that I remember the most, and it's so vivid, you know, for memories from that age to last so long,
right,
and to have been with me for so long, really says to me that there's something there. And one of the more distinct memories I remember is standing in the hallway. My parents were watching TV in the living room behind me. And I would look into my bedroom and see these lights floating. And then the whole bedroom would sort of start glowing. And it was, and I realized at this time it was this playmate, this invisible playmate that I had. And I would just be so overcome with fear, I would fall down, like paralyzed, and pass out or go unconscious or something. And when I would wake up, I remember getting up and my parents are just sitting in the living room as if nothing had happened, you know, watching TV. And I that always puzzled me. Like, if what, here I am falling down in this hallway, overcome with fear and going unconscious. And when I come back to consciousness, it's like nothing happened as far as they were concerned. So these things happened a couple of times. And then, you know, so I was so terrified of my bedroom. You know, every night I would just be terrified. And one night in particular, I remember waking up at the bottom of my basement steps. And if you can imagine as a kid, you know how terrifying a dark basement is in your house when you're a kid and waking up at the bottom of the steps there and having no idea. You know, of course, you know, it could all be explained by sleepwalking or, you know, these sorts of things. But the lights, you know, that's what that whatever this experience was, it manifested by my bedroom just being illuminated in this really bright light. And that, you know, when something like that happens and you can't shake it off as you grow older, you know, I really think that was sort of pivotal in me spending so much time, you know, trying to understand all these different variety of phenomena, you know, that fall under the broad umbrella of the paranormal.
Right. And I like the fact that you're not like trying to define what happened to you. You're just explaining what happened to you.
Yeah, that's a big thing for me. You know, I also talk to a lot of people, and when I give talks about UFOs or other paranormal subjects, inevitably people come up and they want to tell you their stories. Mm-hmm. And you know, so many people have so many different stories, and I believe them that they're telling me the truth, you know, as far as they understand it about what happened. But I think, do you know Jerome Clark? Have you ever read any of his stuff?
Yeah.
He's a great writer, and he said to me once, this has never left me. He said, we can believe people when they tell us about their experiences. We don't have to believe their explanations.
Yeah,
and I found that to be a really solid thing to keep in mind, because, you know, one person will say, well, you know, I met these beings and they are Pleiadians, and, you know, they're downloading wisdom into my head and things like that. You know, that person believes that.
Right.
But and they may have had an anomalous experience. They may have had a similar experience similar to someone else. Someone else would explain that experience differently. So I think it's key to focus on the experience itself and to sort of remain agnostic about explanations, because when you start to grab a hold of an explanation, especially with these weird experiences where we don't have, you know, a logical explanation we can grab onto, you can really get stuck in a rabbit hole or a reality tunnel, and then everything you start to build your reality around these explanations instead of letting the data lead you in that direction. Yeah. And this happens all the time. You know, people get convinced, oh, these UFOs are gray aliens, but then when someone has a sighting and it doesn't fit the gray alien mold, you know, then what do? You know, it doesn't compute. They can't fit it into their, you know, their ideology. And I think that's where a lot of paranormal investigators, a lot of writers go wrong, is that they start trying to funnel everything into their belief system without actually just letting the data lead them in the right direction.
And you get people who have such intense experiences, and it seems like they've been told the truth. You know, maybe the beings that, you know, seem to have abducted them told them they were Pleiadians.
Mm-hmm.
So they have no reason not to believe that.
Sure.
So they just relay that information as if it's solid truth, not realizing that it was probably a mask.
Sure. And you know, that's my issue with channeled material. Mm. You know, I know a lot of people very sincere about, you know, believing that what, you know, what these entities they're channeling or are, you know, or ascended masters and that sort of stuff. But, you know, the way I look at it is, hey, just because an entity doesn't have a physical form does not make it all-knowing and wise. You know, I don't leave my front door or my house open and just let people come in and start, you know, spouting wisdom at me. So what, you know, why should I trust something just because I can't see it in a physical form? Why can't it be, you know, a lying, you know, trickster? And you know, the trickster is such an element of this stuff that I tend to be doubtful at first. You know, I'm not going to accept something, and you know, I think that's the probably the safe and sane and reasonable way to address this stuff.
The channeled material I've always been very hesitant on, or downright dismissive at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And the only channeled material that ever impressed me was Jane Roberts.
Yeah, it's her material is fascinating, and it's so well developed. You know, the whole philosophy and the cosmology behind it and everything. It's fascinating stuff. And, you know, I believe that channel material is wrapped up, you know, in this wider sort of encapsulation of the paranormal. And, you know, it goes back to, you know, spiritualism and shamanism and, you know, it really what it is it's a belief in spirits or entities or non-corporeal intelligences of some sort, which is really where most of my research is centered. So, you know, channeling is sort of part of it, but you know, it's just, again, I'm not going to take something's word that is telling me the truth. Same with, you know, a vision someone might have under DMT, or, you know, a spiritualist bringing forth the spirit of a dead person, things like that. I'll listen. I'll you know, acknowledge that maybe this is something speaking through the person. But I'm not necessarily going to buy into the explanation of what this thing is saying it is or its message.
Right. Now, you've also, you're a mentalist.
Yes, yes.
And do you want to explain to people a little what that is exactly?
Yeah, mentalism is a branch of magic that simulates psychic phenomena. So, it, you know, spoon bending, mind reading, precognition, anything that falls under, you know, psychic abilities. But it's a magical way of creating this stuff. And it's different, you know. I meet a lot of mentalists, and they're not like a lot of magicians are. A lot of magicians, particularly nowadays, sort of fancy themselves in the Amazing Randy or the Penn and Teller debunker types. You know, they're out to mock and make fun of you know, psychic research and things like that. And they're very much materialists, rationalists. And, you know, that's fine. That's not where I come from. But mentalists are usually different. And mentalists, I find, a lot of them, they actually believe in psychic abilities. And sometimes it's because one of their tricks has gone wrong, and they have to do it for real on stage. You know, I've talked to several who have said, you know, I just said, I don't know, seven of diamonds. And, you know, sure enough, it was a seven of diamonds, even though their trick had gone completely wrong.
Wow.
And I also think there's an element of when you fake something long enough that maybe you start to do it for real. And that's, I got into mentalism because I believed in psychic abilities. Like I said, I grew up and immersed in this stuff. And I found a book on mental magic in my local library, and I started trying this stuff out. And I was amazed at the power that it had. And I was hypnotizing people when I was, you know, 9, 10, 11 years old, and it worked. And I'm thinking, holy crap, man. I mean, this is powerful stuff. And what mentalism also, it kind of, there's a really thin barrier between the trickery of mentalism and the real stuff. Because mentalism incorporates things like hypnotism, body magic, you know, certain things you do with your body that that seem to transcend physical abilities. So there's a lot of really interesting stuff in mentalism that comes close to real magic.
I would think that someone like David Blaine would be a good example that people might know.
Yeah, David Blaine. You know, most of the mentalism's gotten really popular with you know, famous magicians, because I think it's because, you know, if a magician comes up and does a little trick and makes a coin disappear, pulls it from behind your ear, you know, that kind of thing, or even if it's a larger scale illusion, you know that that stuff is trickery. It's still great. It's still compelling. But if David Blaine walks up and asks you to think of a card, and you think of the three of clubs, and then, you know, he reaches into the back of his throat and pulls out this, you know, saliva-soaked card, and it's your card. I mean, that's weird. That's more real. People have a much, I just think it's more adult magic, because we think, wow, that just might be real. You know, making the lion, you know, disappear from a box or something like that, we know that's a trick.
Right.
But when someone does something that seems to be reading our mind or playing with our thoughts, Darren Brown is another good mentalist. I don't know if you've seen him. He's a British mentalist, but he works his stuff under the idea that he's influencing your mind. He's using subliminal influences and things like that. So mentalism just has I think it has more power, because it seems like maybe this stuff is real.
Yeah. And now you've had an experience where people, even though you've told people right up front it's a trick, not everyone believes you.
Yeah. Excuse me. That was really an eye-opener for me about the desire to believe among true believers. I was doing a talk on mentalism at a Fortean conference for like the works of Charles Fort,
right.
A conference that was held every year in Baltimore. And so I did this really, you know, pretty amazing trick where people would write down their thoughts, stick them in an envelope, and I never opened the envelope. And, you know, I'd ask one person to think of a name of an old friend, one to think of a four-digit number, that sort of thing. And boom, you know, I just by looking at them, I gave them the answers. And it's a really powerful trick. And afterwards, a few people came up and they said, you know what, I know that that wasn't a trick. And it was three of them together. They'd been discussing this. And I said, no, I did this to show you how easy it is to trick people that you have psychic powers. And they said, no, we've talked about this. And there's no possible way that could have been a trick. So you really did use psychic power. And they would not believe me. You know, I mean, that was a real eye-opener. And I just recently had a talk at the last Fort Fest, which was a few weeks ago, with George Hansen, who is a magician. He wrote a book called The Trickster and the Paranormal. Great guy, great theoretician of the paranormal. We were talking about that, and both he and I have talked to paranormal investigators, one in particular I won't name, who've written a couple books. And I asked George if he had asked this guy if he had taken a mentalist or a magician with him. And George said, oh, no. He said, he told George, he said, no, my perception is good enough. I don't need a magician. I don't need a mentalist. And, you know, that's where people go wrong. If there's someone who is displaying an ability that looks psychic and you really want to do a good investigation, you absolutely need a magician or a mentalist for the reason that anecdote explained. When those people were insisting that I had used psychic powers, even though I was telling them flatly to their faces that it was a trick. You know, if you want to believe something, even if you're if you scrutinize that person to the best of your ability, if you're not a magician, you don't know the tricks to doing these things, you can get suckered. And then you're going to be embarrassed down the line when a magician comes along and proves, you know, that you were taken advantage of and they were hoaxing, if that is indeed the case.
Right. Now, yeah, and George is a magician. I don't know, he's not a mentalist, is he?
He's both. I mean,
oh, is
he's,
he? Okay.
Yeah. He's well versed in mentalism as well, especially the kinds of mentalism that's used. You know, it's often used like by people claiming to be psychic.
Yeah, I always feel his book Trickster and the Paranormal is a must read, but it's also a really hard read.
It is a hard read. I mean, he gets into, you know, he gets into ontology and language and, you know, postmodern French philosophy and things like that. It's heady stuff. You know, I've taken a few read-throughs to really, you know, to really get it all. But he's, I just think he's, I think he, along with Jeffrey Kripal, are probably the two leading theorists on the paranormal nowadays. They're both brilliant. I recommend them both to your listeners.
Okay, all right. Luke, didn't you say that Hansen's book was required reading in one of your classes?
Yeah, it was. It was a comparative religion studies course.
Ah, okay. That's interesting.
Hey, can I take your class?
Well, he's not teaching the class.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. No.
I just graduated from the college, that's all.
Oh, cool. Congrats.
Okay, so as far as mentalism goes, you do believe there are actual legit psychic abilities out there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I think anyone who follows the research closely, you know, the parapsychological research, unfortunately, you know, it's the redheaded stepchild of science, and it's just so marginalized, and the funding is so limited that, you know, there's just not a lot of research going on. There aren't many parapsychologists who make a living doing the research anymore. But there is good research being done, and if you look at it, it's scrupulous, you know. And the problem with the skeptics is they always want to move the goalposts because it is unsettling. It challenges the orthodoxy. So they say, well, you know, in any other case, I might buy this research, but because you're saying that there is a, you know, there's a measurable instance here that would indicate that there is some sort of psychic ability, either, you know, like Daryl Bem's precognition studies, things like that. They say, well, we need more proof. We need better proof than we would to accept anything else. We would use the same statistical models, and in any other case, we would say, yes, you have shown that there is a statistical anomaly here. It exists, and we don't know how to explain it. What they do, they say, well, because we can't believe that it's real, we're going to insist on an even higher level of proof.
Right.
And then they keep moving the goalpost and moving the goalpost. But you know, even, you know, I think the lab studies, you know, the really controlled scientific studies are important. But I think anecdotal evidence is important as well.
You know, I agree.
I mean, you know, we are creatures of, you know, we tell stories, and that's how we communicate with each other. And if you just open yourself up to listening to people's stories, you know, you start hearing some really incredible stuff, and just the overwhelming amount. And things like, you know, things like these crisis apparitions that have been studied for hundreds of years and go back, you know, thousands of years. You know, when people will see someone appear at their bedside, you know, a loved one or something, and then they find out a day later, 2 days later, the person died when they saw them. Now, this stuff, it's been extensively documented.
Yeah.
But it can't be replicated in a lab. Well, sorry, it can't be replicated in a lab, but lots of things can't be replicated in a lab. That doesn't mean it doesn't have validity.
Right.
And we shouldn't look at it, and we shouldn't give credence to these stories and try to create models that maybe explain them.
Now you say the skeptics move the goalposts, but these people are not truly skeptics. They are debunkers.
Yes,
they've absolutely. They've just as bad as true believers. Anyone who's completely made up their mind about this stuff is probably wrong.
Yeah, it's, well, you know, I think that the prime example is Philip Klass, the UFO debunker. And yeah, I used skeptics with, I guess I should have put quotes around that. but you know, I talk about UFOs sometimes because it's been a fascination to me. I had a sighting of my own in 1990, which kind of blew, you know, the top of my head off. But you know, there's one of the most extensively documented UFO sightings was in Iran in 1976, where there were fighter planes chasing these right. objects around. There were ground sightings. It was captured on radar. You know, so people in the air are seeing these objects. People on the ground are seeing them. They've got radar tracking. They've got people in Tehran who are looking up in the sky and watching this stuff. And Philip Klass, the debunker extraordinaire of UFO phenomena, came out and said that all of that was explainable by a misperception of Jupiter, of the planet Jupiter. Now that is not a skeptic. That's a dogmatist. That's a liar. You know, yeah, I mean, there's no way he could have believed that was true. But you know, there's a strong, there's just a huge brigade of people who have taken it upon themselves, especially now online, and they're just rabid debunkers, and they just want to shoot anything down that reeks to them of, you know, the horrifyingly banal word woo. You know, if I never have to hear that word again, I will die happy. You know, it's just as soon as someone starts talking about anything that stretches materialism or reductionism, you know, instantly the anti-woo brigade comes out. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's completely unscientific, and it's sad because you know, I've been attacked online. My website got taken down, I think, probably. Really? Probably by, you know, I don't know if it was, but I had just published something attacking Richard Dawkins when he was going off about Harry Potter, or how pernicious fantasy, you know, literature could be. And I started getting all these comments on my blog, and then a DOS attack took it down. So, you know, who knows?
Yeah.
But these folks, I wouldn't put it past them. You know, it's a crusade. It's a crusade against what they believe is irrationalism, but what is actually, you know, the most important kind of research that's being done. That, you know, it's boundary, it's envelope pushing research, and they don't like that. So they'll do anything to take it down.
Do you want to tell people a little bit about your UFO sighting?
Yeah, it's that sighting really was kind of the real basis of Blackwater Lights, and the sighting that the main character Ray has in the book is very much based on my sighting. I was in Ocean City, Maryland, which is a beach town, with my girlfriend at the time in 1990, and I'd been having dreams all weekend about UFOs, and there were all kinds of weird little synchronicities and things it would take too long to get into, but it was lots of strange stuff happening that weekend. So the night we were leaving, we walked out to the beach, just the two of us, and we were all alone. There was no one else on the beach. It was September 23rd, 1990, and it was a beautiful clear sky. So because I'd been so kind of caught up in thinking about this stuff, I looked up at the sky, and this is where I lose a lot of people, but you know, hey, it's a paranormal show, so I'm going to tell you what happened, and everyone can make up their minds. But I looked up in the sky, and I said mentally, inside my head, I looked up and I said, "Okay, if you're out there, now is the perfect time to show yourselves." And you know, there was maybe 0.5% of me that thought something might actually happen, you know? Sorry, my phone just went off.
Oh, okay.
With an Amber Alert or something in the background. or either that or the MIBs are coming. But you know, there was maybe a tiny percent of me that thought, hey, maybe something will happen. So a few minutes later, my girlfriend points up at the sky, and she goes, "What are those?" and I followed where her finger was pointing, and there were two orange lights, and they were just sort of bobbing in place. And as soon as I looked at them, they shot across the sky. And I grew up near an airport, so I know what airplanes look like when they're flying, and I know what helicopters look like. These things were propelled. They were going extremely fast, and they were doing crazy maneuvers. And at one point, they came together and sort of fused as one light and flew around a little bit like that. And then they broke up again. And the whole time I was just saying, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. And my girlfriend saying, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. And and then they just at one point they just shot off. I mean, like lightning across the sky. So, you know, it's one thing, I think, to see a light in the sky or in, you know, these weren't Chinese lanterns. This was long before I think people started sending those things up anyway, but these things were propelled. I mean, they were going fast. They weren't being blown about by the wind. Right. So, you know, it's one thing to see lights in the sky. It's one thing to see a craft or, you know, whatever, but to ask to see something and then to have it appear, you know, and that really shaped my way of looking at the UFO phenomenon as something that's not just spaceships in the sky, but maybe it's something kind of deeper and weirder, and it's tuned into our consciousness in a way that's beyond just, you know, a spaceship. And you know, that's when I started, you know, I'd read stuff by Jacques Vallée and John Keel, mm-hmm. and Charles Fort, you know, who sort of, you know, they suggested that UFOs are part of something bigger, like the whole paranormal experience might be just different aspects of one thing, whatever this thing is, some kind of intelligence, some kind of agency that manifests in different ways, you know, but somehow it's tied to our consciousness. And that's what it wants to do. It wants to interact with our consciousness rather than just come down and take, you know, skin samples or probe us or whatever. You know, this stuff is working on a deeper level, I think. And that's where my research sort of detoured, and I started studying the entities, you know, seen by people, you know, when they take DMT or ayahuasca, that the entities people talk about and practices of ritual magic or you know, things like that. I mean, maybe there is a common denominator in this. I don't know, but that's what intrigues me the most.
Well, I think there's definitely a connection between the altered states, occultism, and the UFO phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
Myself being involved in ceremonial magic at one point realized as I'm reading Whitley Strieber's stuff that, hey, I've had a lot of these experiences, but they weren't UFO related.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you can read, you know, stories, you know, of, you know, ceremonial magicians and things and the entities they encountered. And you weigh those against, you know, these entities people see when taking DMT or mm-hmm. ayahuasca. And you look at the, you know, what the UFO experience too. And you're right. I mean, it all takes place in an altered state of consciousness. It doesn't happen in ordinary reality. You know, somehow, you know, either our consciousness serves as a gate for these things, possibly, which I deal with in my fiction, you know, maybe that's how they get to us, through an altered state of consciousness that makes us more open, accessible to them, whatever they are. You know, that's what I'm still trying to get at. You know, what do they want? You know, sure, they like to play tricks on us. They like to tell us things. They like to tell us that they're higher beings and all that stuff, but what are they really, you know? Yeah. Do they come out of us somehow? Are they some other sort of being? Are they spirits? Are they demons? Are they ultra-terrestrials in Keel's term? Are they just figments of our minds? You know, I think there's a good argument for all of these, but damn if it isn't interesting stuff.
The other thing is it leaves traces in the ordinary world, and that's where it gets kind of hard to separate. You know, you can say, well, it's all DMT until you get to those physical traces, and then you say, well, then what left the physical trace?
Exactly. It's a phenomenon that works through our consciousness, but there's also undeniably a physical element. And I'll tell you the other, the second weirdest thing that happened to me. I was taking melatonin. Are you familiar with melatonin?
Yes.
People take it to sleep.
Yep.
It's an over-the-counter neurohormone. And I was using it because I found that taking melatonin amped up my dreams. Mm. You know, I started taking it because I was having trouble sleeping. And before I knew it, I was waking up exhausted from these super intense, complex dreams. And I eventually, you know, through the scientific method, realized that it was the melatonin that was doing this. Well, I was at a bed and breakfast in West Virginia. You know, I guess there's strange things do happen in West Virginia. And I had and I was taking really high doses of melatonin just to see what the higher doses would do. And what happened is I had a sleep paralysis incident that was as terrifying as anything I've ever experienced. You know, you wake up, you can't move. I thought I was dying. I was going to die of fear. And I was certain that there was this evil entity in my room. I couldn't see it, but I could feel it as, you know, as easily as I could feel someone standing next to me. I mean, it was as real as anything I could possibly imagine. And so, you know, like these things passed, though. Like somehow I fell back asleep. But for that brief moment, it was absolutely, I thought I was going to die from terror. I really thought I was going to have a heart attack or something. Well, the next morning when I woke up, my girlfriend looked at me and said, "What's that on your chest?" And I couldn't see it looking down. So I went and looked in the mirror, and there was a handprint on my chest. So I thought, well, it's, you know, I was sleeping on my hand or something like that. But this handprint, I couldn't fit my hand to it. And it was bigger than my hand. The fingers were longer, the hand was bigger. And then what really freaked me out, it had six fingers.
Hmm.
This thing looked like it was painted on my chest. I mean, it was not like a, you know, it was so bright red and vivid. It looked like it was paint. And unfortunately, this was before, you know, everyone had a phone on their camera. And I didn't have a camera with me. And eventually it faded. But, you know, you talk about leaving traces, you know. I mean, I spent 10 minutes trying to fit my hand to this thing, and I couldn't do it, you know. And also, I don't have six fingers. So what the hell was that? You know, did my body produce that somehow? Or was it, you know, a trace left by that, you know, that sleep paralysis thing? I mean, you know, so that's the kind of thing. You know, once something like that happens to you, it's hard to go back to prosaic explanations for this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things we've been doing a series on the history of UFOs, and one of the things we've said is that in the end, the only thing you can really say is this thing is alien, not necessarily extraterrestrial, but alien to us.
Yeah,
in all the ways it appears to us. I mean, it's not us, whatever it is, and you got to wonder if it's something. You know, I mean, maybe it's here with us, but it's on such a different wavelength or a different way of existing that it's trying to create a common connection between us and it.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a desire. It has a desire to interact with us. It has a desire to show itself, but it also hides itself. You know, it's paradoxical. And, you know, I'm sure you're aware of the work of Jacques Vallée. It was really sort of a pioneer of looking back historically and seeing, you know, the fairy stories and the analogies with the UFO phenomenon. And again, Jeffrey Kripal does a lot of that comparative study of this stuff too. It's, you know, I have to believe that it's been with us as long as we've been here. And it changes. You know, what is it doing? Is it trying to open our minds to higher realities? Is it just, you know, messing with us? Is it feeding off of us? You know, does it get something from us from these exchanges? You know, is it good? Is it neutral? Is it bad? I think the jury is still out.
And I think, you know, there are a lot of people who speculate things like the black-eyed kids encounters are them feeding off our fear.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, clearly this stuff causes fear. And, you know, these experiences are fearful. Even when I just saw those lights in the sky, I was scared afterwards. You know, I wanted to get the hell off the beach, you know, because I thought, what's next? You know, and, you know, is this a prelude to something? I'd read enough books that, you know, terrify me. And you read Whitley Strieber's stuff. I mean, the guy was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder from what happened to him. You know, so it's, you know, if they're benevolent, they sure are, you know, they sure are doing a terrible job of you know, bringing us enlightenment. So I think, you know, the jury's really out as to what, you know, what is the goal, if there is a goal, or if it's just, hey, you know, let's mess with these humans and let's have some fun. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, at the same time, people, when they deal, like Strieber, as he dealt with the situation differently, it went from being fearful to being more positive. And John Mack's work showed the same thing. The people who approached it without that fear got something positive out of it.
Yeah, you know, I think it's how you process it. Strieber in particular, I mean, I love the guy, I love his work, but he's gone back and forth so many times.
Yeah.
You know, but they're demons, they're angels, they're this, they're that. You know, I think he's probably still, you know, I'm not sure if he's really made up his mind. And honestly, you know, if something rapes you, you know, even if it's doing it for some higher purpose, I have a hard time believing that's an act of love or of benevolence, really.
Right.
Yeah, and if you look at the history, you know, you talked about ceremonial magic. I've studied that extensively too, and you know, there's, if you look at it from that perspective, there are angels, you know, there are demons, you know, there are gradations. I mean, if there are non-corporeal or discarnate beings, maybe some are good, maybe some are just jerks.
That's true. You know? That's true. Yeah. And it could also be that they're all different depending. I mean, just like people are. Right. Some people are great people, except for that 10% of the time.
Right. You know, if aliens or, you know, ultra-terrestrials come in my house, and, you know, why is that any different than, you know, like the earlier analogy, leaving my door open, you know, people wander in my house. They might be nice people. They might, you know, make me a sandwich, or they might, you know, tie me up and do horrible things to me. I think we have to remain very much agnostic when we're dealing with this stuff.
Yes, yeah. And again, I think anyone who's made up their mind that, you know, okay, so UFOs are this, they're gray aliens, you know, they're here to experiment on us, or, you know, create a hybrid race or whatever, as soon as you make those assumptions and you view everything through those assumptions, you miss the whole picture.
Yeah, it's the kiss of death. You know, you wrap yourself, you know, like Robert Anton Wilson called it, reality tunnels. And as soon as you're in that reality tunnel, you're missing all sorts of other stuff that's outside of it. And it just gets tighter and tighter the further you go down the tunnel. So you have to remain agnostic and open-minded, or it's the kiss of death. In this stuff in particular, because it is so nebulous and it's so easy to get lost, and so easy just to get pulled into. So, I mean, you've seen lots of paranormal investigators go over the edge, you know, and, you know, it's a hard thing to see. But it's dangerous, you know. Magic, the paranormal, is dangerous stuff. And the danger comes when you lose your objectivity and you lose your discernment. That's when things go bad.
And you almost got to wonder if it preys on you more at that point, too.
I think so, yeah. I mean, the Golden Dawn magicians, you know, back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, you know, they talked about obsession. That's what happened when, you know, when you'd get the spirits would take a hold of you. And, you know, that's an interesting way to look at it. But you look through cultures all through time, you get possessed, you get obsessed, and yeah, I mean, I think these things like that attention, and you know, you don't want to get you don't want to be food for whatever it is that likes to siphon your energy.
Fair enough. Do you have any questions for him?
No, I mean, we're bringing up very interesting questions. I mean, does illusion become reality when people believe with enough conviction? What does it mean to have a healthy skepticism? Because, I mean, it's something that you need if you're going to study this area. You don't really want to fall down the rabbit hole you're trying to study. But it can be very hard to talk about. Because, I mean, like, how can we talk about these experiences without using those scientific dualisms of good and evil, real, unreal, logical, illogical? It's hard.
And people want answers, you know. People want answers. So when you tell them there aren't any good answers, they don't like that. You know, right. We want answers. We want to know it's, you know, gray aliens from Zeta Reticuli. You know, we want to know that it's Uncle Jimmy talking to us through the spirit medium. You know, we want to believe, you know, the Mulder saying. But you can't believe if the data doesn't support it. You know, that's why Charles Fort was such a, you know, a pioneering,
yes,
you know, intellect, as he said. You just collect the data, and then you just file it away. You don't have to believe this or believe that. You just let it pile up, and then you just build your idea from there.
And it seems with UFOs in particular, it leads people a certain way, and then at the last minute, it gives you the opposite.
Exactly, and that's where the trickster comes in, you know, and that's why a lot of these, you know, these UFO contactees, you'd be told, you know, oh, you know, we've been told to gather our followers because the world's going to end. And then, hey, the world doesn't end. And then, you know, you look like an idiot. Well, you know, maybe you shouldn't be listening to these things. You know, maybe you shouldn't believe. Maybe you should be more questioning, be more skeptical.
Yeah. Yeah. And skeptical in the sense of always asking questions, even of the stuff you think you already know.
Right. Robert Anton Wilson said, belief systems, he abbreviated as BS. He said, never, always question someone else's BS and always question your own BS in particular. And that's the key. You know, when you start believing, oh, you know, you've got to keep yourself separate. You know, you just maintain that discernment, maintain that skepticism about your own beliefs, not just what other people believe.
Yeah. Now, you've also studied shamanism.
Yes, I studied shamanism sort of, you know, on the down low, I guess, because, you know, a lot of the ways to access the shamanic realms were not particularly approved by the government and law enforcement back in the day. But of course, all this stuff happened long enough ago that it is, you know, the statute of limitations is up. But no, you know, I you know, how could I not? You know, the stories were so intriguing about what people were seeing in altered states brought on by, you know, various drugs or plants, things like that. And, you know, so I did personal study for a long time. I met a lot of people in the field. I had experiences from, you know, being in a teepee with Navajos. Hmm. Taking peyote and stuff like that, and you know, all what that did was also it expanded that belief I talked about earlier, that whatever these intelligences, spirits, whatever they are, that they have different, you know, there are different modes of accessing them. Shamanism is definitely one. It's probably the oldest way of, and all shamanism is about, really, cross-culturally across the world, is going into an altered state to communicate with spirits.
Right.
And the parallels, you know, you dig into the parallels between shamanism, between UFO encounters, between spiritualism. It's all the same basic template. Just like you said, it's an altered state of consciousness that facilitates contact with spirits, entities, whatever you want to call it. It's all the same template. It's just different symbolism, different practices, but at its core, it's the same stuff.
Now, you've used more than one substance to alter your consciousness, then?
Yes, sure, certainly. I mean, I for a while, I was exploring salvia divinorum, which is legal in most states, a DMT, ayahuasca. Things like that. I mean, DMT is probably the most powerful means of contacting this other space, this other realm. And all it took was one visit there to really shake up my worldview. You know, it's one thing to read about it. It's another thing to suddenly be in this other place, you know, when you're completely lucid, you know your body's still there breathing, but you are in another place. And there's other things in that place with you. You know, that's a third eye opener, I guess I could say.
how similar were the experiences between the different substances?
Very, very different. Very different. And you know, if you look at traditional shamanism, people will say that, you know, a particular plant has a special kind of spirit with it. So for me, Salvia divinorum was always a little on the malevolent side. It also had kind of a feminine aspect to it. When it would materialize, it was always to my left. And interestingly, as I've talked to people over the years, that's another commonality. And it would appear as almost like a physical vortex. You could feel it. You could feel it energetically. You could see it. If it was there, eyes open, you could see that there was a change off to the left, and it had agency, you know, it had an intelligence behind it, and I never was really quite, you know, comfortable with it, and you know, I don't really go there anymore. You know, knowing, meeting it, and feeling it was enough. You know, I have no compulsion. I know other, you know, researchers who continually use it develop, you know, developing ideas, but, you know, I think, you know, with the research with entheogens and psychedelics and stuff like that, I don't really do it anymore. I think I have enough of an understanding. My focus now is on other ways, meditation, ritual, stuff like that, I think are just as potent. You know, psychedelics or entheogens are a good way to understand other realities and that they exist, and to get yourself there. And there's nothing wrong with it. I think it's a good way to introduce yourself to other realms. But then for me, and only me, other people are different, I find that other ways are more interesting. Yeah. Ways that take a little more work, that require a little more you know, a little more in the way of my body and mind doing it itself.
Mm. Right, right. Okay. Now you have the Blackwater Lights out, and you released
yes.
You released Witch Lights, the second part, when? Like November?
Yeah, Witch Lights came out in October, and it was released at Comic-Con New York. So that
really?
Was kind of fun. Yeah, that was kind of fun. The Random House, you know, set me up to do a signing there. Now, both books are e-books. They're part of Random House's digital imprint called Hydra. So they're only available digitally right now. I hope that maybe at some point they're out in paperback as well, because I know everyone doesn't like, you know, to read e-books or whatever.
Right,
but.
Right.
But yeah, Witch Lights is out, the third book, which is tentatively titled, the working title is Demon Lights. And, you know, again, if you like this stuff we're talking about, that's what these books cover fictionally. So if you like the paranormal, you know, I think you'll find these stories kind of extra fun, because, you know, it's all the stuff we're talking about rolled into them. And I think Demon Lights will probably be out in the winter towards the end of the year, possibly early next year.
So you're basically taking these subjects and playing with them in a fictional way.
Yes, I mean, but I'm exploring them. You know, it's
yeah.
what I'm exploring fictionally is it just allows me to say, well, what if it is, you know, what if altered states do allow these entities to come through? What if there are groups of people around the world who are practiced at this? How would they work? You know, how, if they're involved with governments or if they're involved with, you know, the elites, you know, how would that change the world? So a lot of this stuff is stuff I think about anyway in the real world, but it's so much fun to explore it in a story that, you know, I hope is exciting and compelling and scary and fun.
Okay, and your webpage is what?
It's michaelmhughes.com. You can sign up for my newsletter and get updates on all this stuff. I blog pretty regularly about everything we've talked about, Yeah, I'm on Facebook and Twitter and all that too. Always as Michael M. Hughes, so you can find me everywhere.
Okay. Luke, any last questions for him?
No. Thank you for coming on the show.
No, thank you, man. This is my bread and butter. I love doing this, so I'm happy to come back anytime.
Good, and I plan on having you back because this was a fascinating discussion, and there's so much more we can get into. There's more stuff you've researched, and there's secret societies and other stuff.
So many questions.
So we'll have you back soon.
Thank you very much. It's been a great conversation.
And so some Psyche Corporation to take you out. This is appropriately Nightmares, and we'll be back next week.
Shut the closet door, it's under the floor, the monster's there. Don't leave me here among these ghosts. You promised me nightmares the day I was born. You promised me hellfire, you were so sure. I grew up waiting for demons. Suffering, offering doom, 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 doom. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chill me, slake me, thrill me. I don't want the unicorn, I want the bloodsucker. Modify the uniform, cause I'm a monster. Offering, offering, doom, 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 doom. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chill me, slake me, thrill me. This is a song.